Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is the Progeny hosting for you today.
Hello,
and I'm the Patriarch.
We also have the professor joining us today. What have you been up to this week, Patriarch?
I've been mostly getting up at 5:30 and 6 o'clock in the morning and finding myself at the office from 6:30 till 9 o'clock at night. And working through lunch and eating my salad for lunch. And kind of stumbling home in the dark and waiting for the week to end, which mercifully it did today. But then it all starts again next Monday, so that's something cheery. That's a cheery thought.
For the progeny, school has been canceled for nearly all week. I only went to school one day this week, so it's just you keep on feeling like you have deadlines, but there's no real sense of urgency because you're never going to classes. So I'm just like, it's messing up my entire routine. I don't know what to do. It's first world problems. But the snow is starting to melt, and well, we don't really have any now. It's just kind of the icy rain yesterday. So.
And the time changes.
We're getting ready to get our malaria shots so that we can go to Guatemala in the summer.
And you have your passport. So you
yep. The Pilgrims Podcast is going on an extended trip to correspond with some of our fans. No, we're not really. We're going on a mission trip. I must say, I felt kind of like James Bond when my passport arrived in the mail. I was thinking, man, I can just travel all over the world and do all sorts of stuff. Anyway. Okay, well, since we've been talking about our rather uninteresting lives for the past week or two, we might as well go ahead and talk about the movies. Okay, well, this week, since we'd given a lot of things that were happening in the news and Netanyahu's speech, we wanted to talk about the Jews and kind of the history of anti-Semitism and several different things. We're going to be talking about three different movies this week. One is The Courageous Heart of Irena Sendler, and the second is Conspiracy with Kenneth Branagh from 2001, I believe. And the other is Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. Now, Sophie Scholl is the only one that I warned people last week that we were going to be talking about, so we will be talking spoilers for that movie, but we will not with the other two. If you're interested in seeing Sophie Scholl, it's on YouTube, and I highly recommend it. It's a really good movie. Anyway, I wanted to talk about The Courageous Heart of Irena Sendler first, which is a TV movie from a few years ago, 2008.
Hallmark.
Yeah, which is a Hallmark movie, and when we got the Hallmark movie, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not going to like this. I'm just going to sit here and pretend that I'm watching it and mess around on my computer. But it was, in fact, a really good movie. It was kind of a period piece. It was set in 1940s Poland. It was World War II. And it's about a nurse. Was she a nurse?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who worked in the Jewish ghettos, and her name was Irena Sendler. And because at this point, all of the Jews had been confined to a massive ghetto on the outskirts of town. And she was starting to realize that the rumors about the extermination camps were true, because, you know, the average person didn't really know. It was kind of one of those things where you heard stories and people would disappear, but you weren't really sure what was happening. You could kind of talk yourself out of it, think, oh, well, they moved away, well, they immigrated. What, you know, you didn't really think that the Holocaust was happening. And but she started to deduce it. She started to think there's this. We know this is really bad. We need to figure out a way to solve this problem, or at least to fight against it. You know, in our own way. And so she started out by smuggling Jewish children out of the ghetto, and giving them to Christian families, where they would be raised as Christians and learn to live like Catholic children. And it was really interesting. Partly just in the magnitude of her work, because this was a true story. Irena Sendler died in 2008. She managed to rescue something. You know, it was an amazing amount of children. I think over 1,000. And while she was doing that, she kept a record of each of those children's names and where she had placed them, so that their parents could find them if their parents survived the war. And it was a remarkable story for a you know, kind of a small budget TV production. I thought it was really well put together. It was just the color palette was really interesting. It looked like there was a lot more money in it than normally, that sort of thing. It wasn't a very sentimental movie. I mean, it wasn't a tremendously clever or unique screenplay, but it wasn't. It took an unusual story and dramatized it in an interesting and quite suspenseful way, because this was a story that really took place kind of around the edges of the Holocaust. It never really showed it, like a movie like Schindler's List, for instance. The Schindler's List would be the movie that you would go to actually show the horrors of the Holocaust. But this was kind of a movie that was taking place around the edges, because all the viewers know what's going on, and so you kind of fill in the gaps on your own. Would you say that was the case?
Yes. And it showed the ghettos, you know, the terrible conditions that they were living under, with typhus or typhoid and cholera and all the other diseases that they were faced with.
But mostly it was kind of a suspense movie, and that really worked, because it managed to take you and kind of put you into the mind of people who didn't know what the threat was. You just knew that something really bad was happening. You knew when there were a bunch of children that were taken out and crowded into a train. There's just this huge, huge engine hulking out there, and people were starting to panic. But you didn't know where that train was going. You didn't know about the Holocaust. And it did a really good job of getting you into the minds of those people who didn't have the hindsight of history. They just knew, but it was still terrifying. There was just that uncertainty there, and you weren't sure what was going on. And I thought it did a really good job of dramatizing that. The other thing that it did was, at least for me, it started me thinking about kind of what it meant to be a Jew. And I kind of took that situation and then transposed it onto modern times. And I was thinking, how many Jews do I know? And I started looking through my Facebook friends, looking at last names. And, you know, because for modern Americans, being a Jew, being Jewish, isn't something that's really all that huge a deal. I mean, it's quite different if you're an African American or something, where your culture and your is something that's much very politicized, and people are always talking about that. But for the Jews, I mean, if you're a Jew, it's just another ethnicity. It doesn't seem like it's something that, and to a lot of Jews, it just isn't relevant. There are very few practicing Jews in the United States. So it.
What?
Well, I mean, practicing Judaism.
I would think there's a lot.
Well, but percentage-wise.
Well, yeah, but still a lot.
I think that, I think it was a video put together by Ben Shapiro that said that there were only 10% that were conservative practicing Jews in the United States. I'm not entirely sure about that statistic. I'll have to look it up, but to most Jewish people, it's just simply not something that would be all that relevant to them. And then I started, going through all the lists of Hollywood.
What's not relevant?
Well, just on a daily basis, the fact that you're a Jew doesn't make a difference.
I don't believe that.
Really?
Yeah. I just don't. I mean, I think even the... No, I would think that most Jews that are, or Jewish heritage, they probably have their communities that they are familiar with. I mean, it's a cultural thing, if nothing else. It may not be like a religious thing for them anymore. But I think they would keep up with what's going on in Israel, at least tacitly. I think they would want to know what the United States policy is toward Israel and that kind of thing.
You have so many liberal Jews that don't really support Israel.
I think it's more than 10% that hold their Jewish heritage as something very special. More than 10%.
Yeah, I would just say things that along the lines of it doesn't feel like anti-Semitism is something that I at least for me, that I see a lot around here, or in America. That's something that I didn't think was all that big an issue. Anti-Semitism, it's just not something that comes up. When I look at Steven Spielberg, I don't think of him as a Jew. I just think of him as a person. I don't immediately engage with that. But if you were living in Nazi Germany, then they're just going to start, and suddenly, it just felt really random. It's a little bit hard to describe how I was watching the movie, and suddenly, people were just suddenly revealed to be Jews. I just started going through a list of the people that I watched on TV
We live in a very ethnically scarce area, though. We just don't have many ethnicities in our the region where we live. So most of that we encounter is through media.
Yeah, I think what I'm saying is that just things that like. I started looking through my Facebook friends and then started picking out people and thinking, oh, they're probably Jewish. My god sister's husband is Jewish. That means she and her children, in Nazi Germany would have been Jewish. And just those sort of things, that it felt so totally foreign to, because just to have a name or to have a grandmother, who was from that culture and, it felt so arbitrary. Felt like something you couldn't control, and that.
Well, I think this whole idea of racism being a bad thing is a relatively new idea. I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm just saying that if you go back 100 years or a couple hundred years ago, and you're Irish and you're living in New York, you're going to be treated like you're Irish and you're living in New York. You're just no one really, I don't think anyone looked at that as a bad thing until really, the past 100 years or so, maybe. That, we, even in the United States, we liberated the slaves and we stopped slavery, but we didn't stop racism, right?
Yeah.
We didn't stop that. Because I think the vast majority didn't see that as something that was bad.
And of course it is. I mean, it's.
I think it is bad, but it's the word racism has been, just watered down so much now to where, when we see real racism, we almost don't. We don't call it for. We don't recognize it. It's too bad. I mean, I think a lot of the things that pass for quote unquote racism today is really isn't. I mean, it's meanness or it's sin, but it's not necessarily one ethnic group seeking to isolate and dominate another ethnic group. I don't know.
On that note, I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of some of the growing tide of anti-Semitism in Europe and even kind of in the United States. It's kind of been a trend that is going up. And there was several articles back right after the Charlie Hebdo shootings that were talking about this, and they basically said that Islamophobia, you know, so-called, is in fact a problem in a lot of European countries. There have been some clashes between Muslims and other peoples, but anti-Semitism is also a huge issue that you just don't hear about as much. You know, in the wake of Muslim terrorist shootings, then immediately we're urged to not be Islamophobic, but in the wake of things like Israel, when Israel was fighting in Gaza, I think last year, then you just didn't hear people saying, oh, don't be anti-Semitic, be careful, don't be anti-Semitic. And there's, what do you think the difference there? Why are people so quick to defend Muslims and not Jews? I mean, if the reality of violence against these people groups is that both of these things are happening right now, that anti-Semitic violence is something that is going on and growing.
I think for one reason or another, the Jews are hated, and I think that's a terrible thing. I mean, by and large, you know, they're a great people, and have done an enormous amount of good in the world. And I don't know, I guess that in some respects people envy that and want good things destroyed. You know, people, I think the devil sets up counterfeits and in some respects Islam is a counterfeit of the Jewish faith. Maybe that, I hadn't really thought much about that, and maybe that's not a good idea, but that's something to think about. And people love to tear things down. People tear down good things. I don't know why we have to do that so much. It's a bummer.
Yeah, the Jews have kind of been civilization's scapegoats for a long time. Oh, bad things are happening. Well, the Jews are behind it. You know, the Jews are the rich guys. You know, they're controlling everything, and these problems are all happening because of them. And that happened in Germany. That happened in Europe. And it's part of it is, I think, just that people need somebody to blame that are convenient. Then you just pick on them.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is, though, that just the reality of anti-Semitic violence isn't something that's really talked about in the media. It's not something that's covered. Not to the degree of Islamophobia. I mean, you hear about Islamophobia all the time, but you don't hear about anti-Semitism. For instance, recently, of course, there was the shooting in France, and right after that, a kosher deli was shot up. And the Obama administration, Obama said something along the lines of that a bunch of random people were shot. Random folks. And the problem was made worse when his staff clarified the issue and said, well, yeah, that was indeed what he meant. He meant that it was random people. It wasn't just Jews, you know. But it was just Jews. I believe that was the gist of it. And obviously the terrorists had gone in there because it was a kosher grocery. And they did end up apologizing for that. But it just shows how out of touch people are. Now, I have not really been covering the whole thing with Netanyahu speaking before, was it Congress or the Senate? Congress. I know that you have followed some of that, so could you kind of give us the gist of what all that's about?
Bibi shows up at the invitation of the House leadership, who apparently didn't bring the White House into the discussion, and they invited Mr. Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, to speak to a joint session of Congress. So they had the Senate and the House, plus some guests. I think Elie Wiesel was there. I have not listened to the whole speech. I've listened to pieces and long parts of the speech. through various venues, but he just really, in my mind, it was just a very dramatic and clear speech. It really reminded me of Reagan, something like he would do, or just a very forceful and clear speech.
What was his topic?
Well, the survival of Israel, and the you know, he made the comment that the leader of the United States thinks about security, leaders of Israel think about survival, and this pending agreement with Iran, which I will admit I don't know all the nuts and bolts of, he was very pessimistic on, I don't know if that's the right word, but he was very, very discouraged that that was moving ahead. And I mean, you know, I think for good reason. The thing about a place like Iran getting nuclear weapons, which may be inevitable, you could argue that's inevitable, but once they have those, they can set up any kind of shop they want. They can say, you know, we are a haven for terrorists. They can openly have, you know, military or even terrorist training camps and invite anybody in the world that wants to come and join this global jihad, and then send those groups out, and they can do that almost completely free and clear because they've got a nuclear weapon, and nobody's going to try to take the chance of starting a nuclear war. Just like with the United States and Russia, or the Soviet Union, is that, you know, we both knew that there was a mutual destruction involved. Well, Iran doesn't care about that. They just as soon get it on, right? And so that makes things even worse. But he spoke very forcefully about that to negotiate with, to try to negotiate this problem away is just not the best solution. I don't know what necessary. I don't remember the points he made to try to, you know, to offer to in lieu of that. But I think it was. I do remember some points that he made to try to spell out how he thought the world should deal with this, and it was basically in the realm of force, I think. And I think that's probably right.
And it's interesting that Israel is always painted as the aggressor in all of these sorts of situations, when Israel is pretty much 24/7 on the defensive, because it is very much outnumbered. All of its neighbors want to destroy it, at least for the most part, I gather.
And it's, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think there's a couple states that probably are a little bit more open to live and let live. I mean, they may not be, they're not going to put a Jewish embassy in their cities, but, you know, Egypt, for example, I think is kind of a live and let live type government. Maybe somewhat Jordan as well, but I don't know as much about that. But all the other, Syria, Iran, Iraq, even Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, I mean, I think they actively have large and very dedicated efforts to the destruction of Israel, either militarily or politically or economically.
Well, while we have the chance here, I would urge you all to check out one of Netanyahu's political ads, which I just thought was hilarious. Which involves babysitting. You ought to look it up on YouTube. Try and find a copy where they've got English subtitles, because it's pretty great.
And you also need to look up Bill Whittle's little firewall presentation on Mr. Netanyahu, who he calls, and he makes a very strong case for leader of the free world. And I tend to agree. I mean, Mr. Obama, I think, has his strong points, but I think he has a blind spot when it comes to Arab and Muslim relations. And I don't know if it's because of his upbringing or his
He's got this strong desire to appease other groups and other nations and just to...
Well, it's an interesting kind of type of leader, because he has grown up in a country which is at peace, which is... And he went to a very liberal school where he was taught to, you know, make peace, not war. All these sorts of things. He has been in that training. But then you have a guy like Netanyahu who's grown up and lived in a country that is at war and has been at war forever, for a long time anyway. I guess it's pretty much its entire history. It's been on the defensive. And it those two different situations call for and create different sorts of people. For instance, in peacetime, Britain produced Chamberlain, but in wartime, it produced Churchill.
I think President Obama is like Mr. Hollum.
Master and Commander.
And Bibi's kind of like Jack Aubrey.
That's a pretty good analogy.
And he tells him, you know, he says it's respect they want. You know, he says, Mr. Hollum says, I try to be friends with them. He says, they don't want to be your friends. They want your, you know, they want your respect. And that's it.
Well, while we're talking about analogies from the 40s, with Churchill and everything, we can move on to Conspiracy, which is 2001 TV movie, I think made by HBO, starring Kenneth Branagh, Colin Firth, and a bunch of other guys, 15 guys around a table. And basically, it's a dramatization of the meeting in which a bunch of Nazi officials got together and decided on the nuts and bolts of the final solution. And it's a chilling movie. It's staged like a teleplay. It's a bunch of guys, get around this table, and they'll have lunch. They'll occasionally move outside of the room, and they're little alliances going on between them and different things. But most of the time is spent in the room where Kenneth Branagh plays the sociopathic general or captain or guy who's leading up the meeting. And he ends up just kind of intimidating everybody else into going along with the way he wants things to go. But the most disturbing thing is that the kind of the basic belief at the table is that, of course, the Jews are a problem. Nobody there is going to admit that the Jews are not a problem. It's just kind of a basic belief. Everybody believes this, and we're going to deal with this problem. The professor once wrote, "I live in the managerial age in a world of admin. The greatest evil is not now done in those sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint. It is not done even in concentration camps and labor camps. In those we see its final result, but it is conceived and ordered, moved, seconded, carried and minuted in clean, carpeted, warmed, and well-lighted offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not need to raise their voices."
Yep, that's exactly right.
Hannah Arendt, I think that's how you pronounce her name, famously spoke about the banality of evil. And it's perhaps the most disturbing thing about that movie is just the quietness of it, the how sterile the whole thing was.
Well, that's so... concerning about that one and the Sophie Scholl movie is that the Germans were just so meticulous, and they were just so, I mean, you just look at the uniforms in that Conspiracy movie, they're just impeccable. I mean, everything is just impeccable, and when they open the doors, the waiters are standing there with the food and everything's ordered. And there's this real, in my mind anyway, there's this real sense that we can fix this. We can make it better. We can put everything right. Just give us the power to do it, and we'll take care of everything. And that's the problem with government when they want to fix us. Because I don't want to be fixed. I don't want anyone to fix me, or to try to fix my country. I'm not into that. I'd much rather have freedom than fixes. And I feel like that's what the Germans were trying to do. And then, they had the best interests of not everyone, but they had...
Or they thought they did,
they
anyway.
They thought they had... This is the best thing for everybody. You know, you'll see. Just trust us. and you'll see that we're going to fix everything. It'll be much better when this is over with. We're going to take care of these terrible problems we've got.
Why do you think that this just kind of this idealism, this lie of Nazism, is so appealing? What did Hitler offer to these people that made them just blindly follow him over a cliff? You know,
I don't know. I guess nationalism. I mean, they were just absolutely whipped into a national frenzy. Think of it as almost as a football team. You can get people who are just absolutely rabid about football, or their political parties. You know, Republicans and Democrats both. They don't want to hear. They don't even want to hear what the other side has to say. It's not what's best for our country. It's what's best for my party, and that's I don't know. I guess it was. That on steroids, and this whole nationalism thing is that, you know, we got kicked around in World War I, and we got the shaft because of the treaties at the end of that war, and we're tired of getting kicked around anymore. We're better people than that, and so they bought into it. And then, you know, you throw out some cool marketing as well, you know, the swastika and the colors, and everything was just kind of
iconography,
choreographed, iconography,
and of course at the historical moment was significant as well. Germany was impoverished, Germany had been humiliated, and this was a people to whom patriotism was just something immensely important. It was really part of the national character incredibly important to them, and they'd been unjustly saddled with much of the load after World War I, and I've been reading about World War I recently, and I think it was unfairly. It wasn't really Germany's fault. It was just a number of things. That whole war was a mess that should never have happened. Should have just been dealt with internally. You can understand a lot of the resentment that was there, and Hitler came along, and he was optimistic, and he really gave them a vision of a free and independent and prosperous Germany. Yes. And it wasn't something cruel. It wasn't something terrible. It was very utopian.
Yeah. You know, I'm here to, again, you know, we're here to make things better, to give you what you deserve. Right?
Yeah.
And that's a dangerous road to go down, because then we all think we deserve more than we...
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're up to our primary movie now, which is Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, which I think in German is Die letzten Tage. It's about a resistance movement known as the White Rose. There were several students and several older people, but mostly students, that organized this during Nazi Germany, and they would print up leaflets and posters and slogans, and they would put them everywhere, and of course it was secret because the Gestapo cracked down pretty hard on anybody that was spreading dissent. And the movie centers on Sophie Scholl, who was 21. She and her brother were arrested when they planted a huge amount of leaflets in a university. They're arrested fairly early on, and the majority of the movie is spent in the interrogation rooms as Sophie is interrogated. It's kind of a suspense movie. It's incredibly shot, incredibly acted. It's a really taut and spare piece of work. And the first half of the interrogations is mostly just back and forth between Sophie, who's played by Julia Jentsch, and a fellow named Alexander Held, who plays her interrogator. And it's just back and forth as he's trying to crack through her story, trying to get her to break. And eventually, of course, he manages to get her to sign a confession. And the second half of the movie, or the second half of the interrogations anyway, is kind of a philosophical back and forth between the two, which is just fascinating. It's really riveting stuff. Because she's an incredible young actress. She just brings a really luminous glow to the screen. She's one of those few people, with the exception maybe of Paul Schofield and Michael Kitchen, who can take a character who's basically a good person, just a good person, and make them interesting. It's very difficult to take a good character and make them interesting and not self-righteous or preachy, but she's somebody who's very interesting, who's very compelling, and who doesn't feel like a saint, who's somebody who's very relatable. Her emotions, which she keeps very much in check, she does a tremendous job of relaying just through very, very small things. You know, you can see just the way her hand will tremble for a moment, or she'll look out a window, and just little things. And the fellow that plays her interrogator is terrific too. He was very impressive, and he doesn't really understand her, because to her she's a young girl just like his child, you know, about the age of his son. He doesn't understand why she would risk all these things, all the benefits that her life has, because she has a very nice, very, very privileged life, for an idea. And he really doesn't understand that, and especially an idea which he doesn't agree with. And why would she want to fight something so obviously correct as Nazism? And that they ultimately kind of come down to talking about conscience and law. And she asks him, well, why are you trying to arrest us? Why are you trying to arrest a bunch of students? Shouldn't you be doing something important? And he says, well, you know, it's not really my choice. It's just the law. And she said, well, the law is wrong. And he can't conceive of that. He really doesn't get that. And that, I think that's a really interesting focus point there, because that is something that we still struggle with, is the idea of when is it right to fight a law? When is it right to take your conscience and say, okay, I just can't stand for this any longer? And is it worth doing when you know that it probably won't have much of an effect? There's an article going around right now in the New Yorker, which is talking about standing up for ideas, it's talking about the lack of moral facts in the modern school system. And I'll read you an excerpt from it. The fellow says, "When I went to visit my son's second grade open house, I found a troubling pair of signs hanging over the bulletin board. They read, 'Fact: something that is true about a subject and can be tested or proven.' 'Opinion: what someone thinks, feels, or believes.' Hoping that this set of definitions was a one-off mistake, I went home and Googled 'fact versus opinion.' The definitions I found online were substantially the same as the one in my son's classroom. Worse, students are taught that claims are either facts or opinions. They are given quizzes in which they must sort claims into one camp or the other, but not both. But if a fact is something that is true and an opinion is something that is believed, then many claims will obviously be both. For example, I asked my son about this distinction after his open house. He confidently explained that facts were things that were true, whereas opinions are things that are believed. We had this conversation. I said, 'I believe that George Washington was the first president. Is that a fact or an opinion?' 'It's a fact.' 'But I believe it, and you said that what someone believes is an opinion.' 'Yeah, but it's true.' 'So it's both a fact and an opinion?' The blank stare on his face said it all." And I immediately connected to that, because people, there's a real, I think, we have lessened the importance of ideas to the point where we just say, well, it's just your opinion. And who wants to risk something important for an opinion, for mm-hmm. something that, well, I mean, relativism is just so all-pervasive that it's just a real problem.
And especially when someone else is telling you what you should believe.
Yes.
Rather than you sorting it out yourself.
Yeah, in movies like Sophie Scholl or A Man for All Seasons, where people are put on trial for something that's relatively minor, you know, you look at these people and you think, okay, well, I'm not sure that I would want to die just to distribute a leaflet that would probably not do much good anyway. I'm not sure I would want to die just to prove a point to my king about divorce, or about the divine right of kings, you know, or just as just a technicality in the law. But she has this rock solid belief that dying for an idea is just as important as dying for another person, or something along those lines. And that's really foreign to people now. The idea that I would risk my life for an idea, you know. We're so materialistic. It's just, why would I do that? I mean,
well, and even, you know, the couple that lost their bakery because they wouldn't bake the cake for the gay wedding.
Yeah, and people immediately latch on to the wrong aspect of that story and say, well, you know, they're hypocrites because they disagree with abortion, but they support this company which does this or that. But
well,
that's not the point. Is not the point.
They had also refused to bake a divorce cake. Okay.
Yeah.
And they had also, and so, you know, I heard someone say this week that they wouldn't, just like if it was a publishing, you know, or a printing house that, you know, Westboro Baptist comes up to, and maybe it's owned by a homosexual or something, and Westboro Baptist comes up and says, we want to order 1,000 of these signs from you. They ought to be able to tell them to take a hike. And that's, you know, for the government to step in and say, no, you will do this regardless of what you believe.
Yeah, I was making up that hypothetical, but it's one of those deals where the inconsistency of somebody else's moral conviction or conscience or what their conscience tells them to do is not for me to police. You know, that's not the point. The point is that we need to allow people to follow those convictions, you know, even if they follow them inconsistently, to have that ability to do so. We don't need to... And people even tend to think that if you risk something or risk your life or risk your family's lives for an idea that you're being selfish, that is a selfish action, and that it's not worth losing your life or risking somebody else's life for something abstract. And that, I think that's really sad.
It is sad. It's you know, it's a harbinger of mediocrity. Cultural mediocrity. We all get along. A brave new world, you might say.
Yeah. And I mean, even a lot of the Christians I hear that will talk the big talk in church, you know, when I meet them in the classroom, because I go to college with some of them, well, yeah, I mean, my grades might suffer if I say the things I said in church last week. They don't want to say those things if it's gonna
yeah.
Actually, and I can't say much. I mean, my grades haven't suffered, even though I'm a big mouth on a lot of those issues. But people aren't interested in talking up or speaking up just
right.
About anything, you
okay.
Know. They just want to sit there and get good grades and pass the class.
And that's what happened in Nazi Germany, I think. You know, right? I mean, they were whipped into a fervor, but they were also, they didn't really care if you know, Mr. Goldstein next door disappeared and you know, a new nice German family moved into his house. I mean, they didn't, you know, so what?
Yeah,
who
and
cares,
I mean,
what happened to Mr. Goldstein?
I mean, and probably, you know, he was just moved to a different town, and of course, you
yeah.
Know, it's not inconvenient. If you need to move to a different town, it's not that hard to move.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah, it's for better for everyone.
And obviously, you're being a bigot if you won't bake a cake for somebody. So, it's not all that hard to bake a cake. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
You know, but it is a big deal.
It is a big deal. Yep. And I see those ideas diminishing. I mean, as you know, as as we lose the ability to think about these things on our own, or too lazy to think about them on our own.
Yeah, you know.
But that's a great movie. That Sophie Scholl, that is a great movie. She's, it, you know, one of the things that struck me is that once she signed the paper, then, and the truth, and she could speak the truth, she became a different person, you know.
And
the tables were turned, and he became very he started becoming very uncomfortable, I guess you'd say, and did not like, she was getting in his head, as they say.
Yeah, and it's really remarkable, because you can see his ideas just kind of, and they're so fragile, and so they're just sitting there right behind his eyes, trembling as she just exudes this moral confidence. And he asks her at one point, he says, "You're so gifted. Why don't you think and feel like us? Why don't you think and feel like us?" He just doesn't understand why anybody would, as obviously beautiful and good and intelligent as she is, why she would act like that. He just doesn't get it. And it's really remarkable. Remarkable movie about one of the great Christian heroines of the 20th century.
Yeah, I agree. And probably many more like her that were never known, never heard of. She kind of represents probably many, many people who sacrificed everything they had for those ideas. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it is.
Now, there would be, some people would say, well, wait a minute, you know, ISIS has those ideas too, right? But I think the beauty of Western thought is that, okay, you put your thoughts on the table and I'll put mine. You know, and let's have at it.
And the important thing was that her idea was that idea. Her idea was the idea of two people being able to sit down,
yes,
without coercion.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, the interrogator, she says, "You Nazis, you force people to do things." And he says, "Well, what about your church? You're a Protestant, right?" He says, "Your church has certain things that you have to believe." She says, "Yes, but we're not compelled to come to church. We can go to church if we want to, but we don't have to."
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction.
And that's part of the, you know, this problem with radical Islam. It's similar. We're going to force you to be in this faith, which is no faith at all.
We're about running out of time here, we've run out of topics at this point. I wanted to kind of end on a lighter note, and something I've been having a lot of fun with over the last few weeks is watching a bunch of Marvel TV shows and just kind of enjoying the whole huge American thing that is the Marvel universe. It strikes me that it's a particularly brilliant, I guess, corporate invention of these TV shows that they've made to act as companions to the cinematic releases of big movies like Captain America or Iron Man or the Avengers. Of course, the next Avengers movie is coming up. And they will take bit characters, little minor characters that Marvel movies are so good at adapting, and then just make a whole series around them. And things are happening in this alternate universe. And it's really clever, because you can watch one episode of the show, and then meanwhile, in theaters, Captain America 2 has come out, and you come back the next week to watch the next episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and that what happened in Captain America 2 affected what is happening in the TV show. So you need to go to and see the movie if you want to find out what's going on with the TV show. And it's a really clever marketing thing. But over the last, I guess, 8 weeks, I've really been enjoying Agent Carter, which was kind of a, it was just a show set in the 1940s as well, but it's after the war, and I thought it was a, compared to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is a fairly pedestrian show visually. I thought it had some really terrific visuals, and as a miniseries, it was able to be much more compact and clever in its storylines, and some really good performances too. It wasn't Shakespearean, but is it just me, or are all the good actors in these types of shows British? I mean, like the three lead actors in this show were all British, even though one of them was pretending to be an American. Anyway, what did you think about the show? I know you were a little bit more ambivalent towards it.
Yeah, I didn't see it all. It was okay. It's neat marketing for Marvel. I mean, they know what they're doing. They've got a kind of machine set up, but it had its moments, I guess.
What's been your favorite Marvel movie so far?
The Avengers movie.
Yeah.
The Avengers movie was flawless when it comes to that kind of thing. It was funny, it was exciting, it was fast-paced, it was visually cool,
and of course
it had a couple stumbles, but it was worth the price of the ticket for that one.
Yeah, I'm hoping that Agent Carter gets a second season anyway, because
I will say that the first Spider-Man movie back in the 90s, I guess, where, you know, they kind of started to bring the whole thing to life, that was fun too. That maybe a little dated now, but...
Well, you know, Marvel's acquired the rights to Spider-Man now, so Spider-Man may turn up in the Avengers.
That'd be cool. That'd
yeah, be. It's and the whole franchise, of course, kind of capitalizes on the comic book audience
Then they're redoing Fantastic Four, which is good. They needed to be redone.
Well, I thought that the whole trailer for that looked so generic. I mean, it didn't tell you anything about the plot. I didn't recognize any of the actors.
It's better than
the other one. Yeah, I mean, that's not saying much though.
I forgot what I was gonna say. Oh, it reminds me of one of the Avengers trailers, though. It looks much more promising. Because one of Fantastic Four was one of my favorites growing up.
Really?
Yeah. Good stuff.
For our listeners' information, the Patriarch has always been a big comic book aficionado, so...
Back in the day.
Yep, so he's enjoying all these reboots.
Yep.
Anyway, I'm really hoping for an Agent Carter season 2, because it's a nice change from a lot of the American TV shows. It's a period piece, it's very stylized, and for the most part, pretty classy. You know, it's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has kind of gotten into the soap opera territory at times, with characters sleeping with each other and so on and so forth, and who cares anyway. But yeah, I mean, I've really enjoyed watching it, and watching it with the kids too. So, well,
kids.
What kids? My two younger siblings.
Oh.
Yep. Okay, well,
so what if one is a patriarch or a progeny, what's two? Progeny?
I think that is the plural, though. Progeny? My brother would probably come up with some sort of Greek word, because he's been explaining to us the virtues of Diogenes and Socrates and, you know, asking me if I had to marry one of the two, which I would rather marry, which isn't a question you get asked every day, but unless you live with my brother. Okay, well, we better wrap this up. If you have any comments about the show, you can let us know at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter. We've got a Twitter page, The Pilgrims Podcast. I'm now on Tumblr, which has been fun. I've been posting a bunch of pictures from our Tale of Two Cities Dreamcast. Wait a minute. We forgot to tell everybody about my granny. I asked her if she had any suggestions, and she said that the only ones she could come up with was that Madame Defarge should be played by Angelica Houston and Dr. Manette by Jack Nicholson. I would imagine her version is going to be set like in Las Vegas or something. Hmm. On prompting, she said that the three main characters would be played by, Gregory Peck and Clark Gable, or maybe it was Clark Gable and Cary Grant, and then Audrey Hepburn as Lucy. And, you know, since this is a cast that will probably never happen, that would work pretty well, I guess. Anyway. Okay, well, next week we're going to be talking about Les Mis, the 2012 version of the musical. I believe it's 2012, starring Hugh Jackman. So you can check that out before we review it next week. So, in the meantime, die Sonne scheint noch.